Bonjour, bienvenue à Pod Stallions. Je m'appelle Brian avec mes amis Jason.
Bonjour.
Bonjour. That's all the French I've ever learned in grade school.
Où est la bibliothèque?
Yeah, wait, I also know whether or not I am eating an apple.
Où est le soleil?
That sounds like Spanish.
Voulez-vous coucher avec moi?
Yeah, I know that one. Okay. I also know all the Quebec swears because my
can you give us one?
Says them all. They're all against the church. They're really weird. Calice, which is just the chalice the priest uses.
And that's like she stubs her toe.
That's like a bad word.
She drops a stapler on her foot.
Carlise, you know, and you're like, now I got to go say Hail Mary, which, you know, to me just sounds hilarious. Like,
I love it.
But that, yeah, I can remember, I was dating a different French girl and somebody had just joked about like, next time you screw up playing pool or something, say tabernacle. And I said that, and she was like, don't say that. That's a dirty word. And that just means tabernacle. Like, it's just a different culture.
Interesting.
Yeah. You don't swear against the Catholic Church if you're French-Canadian. Or you do. I don't know.
There were certain Italian words that we learned, but I won't say them on air. But if you said them around my grandmother, oh, my God. She would practically grab a napkin and rip it up and put it in her ears, like stuff it into her ears, because it's like she had to leave the room. And we would just giggle, you know, because we only knew a couple of these words, and she just, oh, she had to leave the room. It was too much. But I won't do that here. But now you're probably all wondering, what could their topic be today?
French swears.
French swears.
Good night, everybody.
It's our new weekly show.
because we haven't prepped and a lot of our kicking back and forth was stuff either you've boned up on but I need to bone on, I thought Isolation's binge watch is perfect because even though I'm back to work, life isn't quite back to normal for me. As soon as I get done work, I come home and I start working on the Toy Ventures magazine, which is thankfully almost done. And I put movies on in the background because, you know, making clipping paths and doing InDesign layouts is sometimes just, it's one of those experiences where you need something in the background, especially when you're like me. So I have been consuming the media, sir, and I imagine you have been as well.
Oh, yes. I don't have anything nearly as time-consuming. Well, that's not true. I wrote a feature script. We'd met with this director, and he was keen, and he was like, well, knock this thing out. I'd love to see it. And so I spent a lot of time on that. And then I finally got feedback on it, which was, I don't know if I even told you this, but this was about 2 weeks ago now. He had other commitments. He does a lot of low budget, you know, direct to DVD type stuff and horror stuff and, you know, a certain genre that does very well, you know, direct to Blu-ray kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so he had kind of sat on it for a while and he finally got a chance to read it because he'd been post on one movie and he was, you know, family and COVID and all this stuff. And we had a conference call 2 weeks ago, and he flipped. He loved it. He absolutely loved it.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so that was like the best piece of news that I've had since all this happened, basically. And he just the only tweak he had was for time. Just was about trying to tighten it up a little bit. So I've been doing that the past couple of weeks, and just kind of handed it off to him. And I'll leave the story there, because the stuff he was talking about was so pie in the sky for me that it's like I can't even.
You can't calculate that.
I can't, because let's put it this way. I'm thinking in terms of, based on, you know, history and things that he's done, I'm thinking in terms of, an Eric Roberts type. You know, get Eric Roberts for a couple of days to be this one character, and then you can put his face on things, and he's got a direct-to-video audience.
The star of a talking cat.
Do you know what I mean? And so he was like, no. And he starts throwing these other names out for some of these characters. And I was like, really? Oh, so we're talking about something else here. This is much bigger. That's been taking up some time. And in between that, once I sort of, you know, I'm usually up till very, very late and doing that stuff. And then I'll skim through it again and, you know, do more tweaks. And then I'll start going through our old friend, Amazon Prime.
Ah.
Insane world that we're now in that, you know, first off, you know, thanks for nothing, Netflix. You can, you know, take a jog. Take a powder, because what Prime does is really extraordinary. The way you find a title, and maybe you put it in your watch list, and then you scroll down, and suddenly there's 50 movies that are within that kind of realm. And I have to say, most of the time, it really is in the neighborhood. Do you know what I mean? Like, it is, like, you pick, like, some exploitation thing or something, and then the list you get is it's not just people that watched what you watched. It's like the algorithm or whatever it is, it kind of goes, oh, he watched that. He might, you know, or maybe Harold and Maude or something. And then all of a sudden it's all like early 70s, you know, yeah, Hollywood type stuff or whatever.
So
and
you're
really
trying to say that
about
Prime has more than just Kung Fu and riff tracks?
Because, believe it or not.
Oh, okay.
Believe it or not. Although I have to say, the riff tracks and the Mystery Science Theater stuff come up a lot for me because it makes sense that a lot of stuff I'm sticking in my list is within that world,
yeah,
of that kind of level of movie.
Hey,
and stuff.
You like garbage.
But it is dangerous, because we talked about this before, but I haven't really gotten much better at it, that I can sit there for over an hour and just be looking at titles,
yeah,
to stick on my watch list.
That's the worst thing, is being like three beers in on a Friday night and spending an hour and a half, because like I have super bad decision making. Like I always want to keep looking for the next thing.
You want to get it right, you know, yeah. There's so little time.
Yeah, and then you start to go, and then I just end up on like YouTube watching someone, like the other night I watched a wonderful, well done essay. It was an hour long by this fantastic YouTube personality named Lindsay Ellis, and it was called Why Is Cats, and it was a beautiful breakdown of why cats suck, which, and I'm sitting there like, I've invested more in this than I did with, like, I turned cats off after 20 minutes, but I'm like just being spoon-fed my own opinion back to me, and of course she's breaking it down to a much more microscopic level and making me understand exactly why it was upsetting me, but it was still like, wow, I like this more than cats.
That's another dangerous avenue to turn off of is YouTube, because I will start doing that too, or I'll watch, oh look, it's Kirk Douglas on the Michael Parkinson show in 1974, which then leads to, you know, Paul McCartney was on the same year, and then it leads to whatever, and the next thing you know, it's a documentary on Noel Coward or something. It's that, you know, the way it just sort of bounces around. When it comes to those kind of things, and this is something I did want to talk to you about, and this is a perfect place to start, because let's talk about some YouTube stuff, is I get people that send me links of like, oh, you know, you dig this movie, you dig this analogy, maybe check this out or whatever. I have to say, most of the stuff I see is pretty well done. They've sort of, they've you know, they've done all right by it. I've seen stuff that is to the extreme where the guy is so in love with his voice that it's like a 2.5 hour sort of thing. But I, every now and then I come across something that's like, it just is what it is, and it is not dripping with snark. If there's anything I'm sick of in this world right now, it is that everything is just dripping with
snark. Oh, yeah, like CinemaSins is the worst thing ever.
You know what I mean? And I like the Red Letter Media guys. I like those guys from way back.
Yeah.
It gets to the point where you go, you can't hate everything and not everything. Because the more you rip everything apart, then you're poking holes and you just go, why are we into any of this stuff?
Well, that's one of the things I like about the Red Letter Media guys is they'll take a terrible B movie, watch it, and go, actually, I enjoyed it.
Well, okay, so that's funny because I found these two guys, and I can't think of their name, Big Daddy something, something, whatever. But they're basically called We Need to Talk About Life Force. You know, We Need to Talk About Remo Williams or whatever. And each one is about 45 minutes or so, and it's two guys. They're in the UK somewhere. They're very likable. They're on camera for some of it. I watched one for Excalibur. I watched one for Life Force, Remo Williams, and Zardoz. What got this started was I said to myself.
I recently watched Remo Williams.
Okay, and for some reason Zardoz popped into my head. Maybe it was Borman or something. And I thought Point Blank was on. That was it.
How did this guy make that?
Point Blank was on TCM, and I thought, what did he do next? King Zardoz. So I went to YouTube and I thought, well, somebody must have done an hour-long documentary on what the hell happened with Zardoz. And this was the first one I found, was these two guys. It was so refreshing because what they did was they break down the plot, they you know, warts and all, and they're happy to, you know, say, and then this comes and this happens. And then they get done with it and they go, okay, so let's talk about this. What happened with Zardoz? And they don't sit there and go, my God, this is the biggest, most awful. Life Force is the biggest piece of shit. Da, 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 da. They don't do that. They go, look at Life Force. You had Tobe Hooper high off of Poltergeist. You had Dan O'Bannon writing the script. You had John Dykstra doing effects. The biggest budget Canon had dealt with at that time, which was like $25 million for this movie. Shakespearean actors. And the score was by Henry Mancini. What happened? But they don't come away from it going, it's just god awful. They come away from each of these going, you need to see this thing. Is it you know, perfect? Is it gold? No, but here's why it's an interesting thing to watch. And I thought that's a lot of what appeals to us is kind of, yeah, some of it, you know, repeat viewing, whatever. When we think of kind of disastrous things or things that are just kind of mental, I mean, it's even part of my love for Dune, where it's like, holy shit, you know, this is insane. I love knowing the stories behind the stuff. And if it's done, you know, respectfully and not like, they still joke about it. They're still, you know, poking fun here and there.
Oh, yeah.
But it's great analysis where they're going, so what happened with this thing? Well, it could have been this. It might have been this. But it is this, and you should see it for what it is, basically. And I just wanted to say that it's out there. These guys are great. I don't know what they're called, but I found it very refreshing to see. Narcolis.
Yeah, it's nice when you can find. So that's one of the reasons that I ever got into the Psychotronica Encyclopedia of Film, was it was very judgment free.
Mm-hmm.
It you know, like the Medved's Golden Turkey Awards, it was kind of snark, 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 snark.
Sure.
And then Michael Weldon did a book called Psychotronic, and I would say that was the defining, you know, B movie book of the 1980s. And the reason was he was editorial free. Unless something was a complete piece of crap, he would basically just say, like, he would, you know, add a little bit like the breathtaking special effects or, you know, something like that. That meant the special effects were not breathtaking. But he just basically described the movie like dryly as possible. And, you know, that basically it sold itself. It was the same way. When I first started writing for Topless Robot, my first article was rejected. And I got some really actually great advice from Rob, who ran Topless Robot at the time. And he said, work around the joke. Never, ever point out the thing that's obvious.
And,
you know, and I really liked that kind of commentary. And I... after Topless Robot, after he left Topless Robot, this new guy took over, and I, you know, he seemed like a nice guy. But the first article that, like, this, the first article that came that I read under the new editorial, the guy was just making jokes like, "Look how stupid this looks," and I remember like, "Oh no, that's not how this is supposed to work." And
you have to assume if you're already watching something about Zardoz, that you might have more than a surface knowledge of what this thing is.
Yeah.
I don't need 20 minutes of jokes about Sean Connery wearing a red nappy, you know, and you know, and a ponytail, whatever. Instead, it's like,
we all know that. That's all we all know.
You can see it. Instead, it's like, what was the thinking behind this? You know, and you know, the bits of dialogue about the gun and the gun and the penis dialogue when Zardoz is like, the penis is evil and all this. And they don't play it, you know, straight. They just go, well, this is what it is. And it's like, okay, but what was he trying to say in this script? You know, there are just some things that may be well intentioned and don't go the way, and that is one of the, and yet it's got this huge following. Zardoz has somehow built up this strange following.
You know how, you're just following rabbit holes sometimes on the internet? The mm-hmm. other day, somebody just showed me all this Zardoz cosplay. There was actually some really attractive women in that outfit, and it's just
I've
like...
I've only seen the men, sadly.
What in God's name is this?
And it's by the way, I say sadly, not because I don't want to see a man in a nappy dress like that. It's that some of the guys that have decided to go with that particular costume probably shouldn't be going with that particular costume, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, we don't have time for that.
We live in
a world of tight-fitting spandex.
But that, so between YouTube and Prime, and then whatever we've got at home, and there are the odd thing or two that shows up on, you know, Netflix and now HBO Max, because HBO Max has this entire Turner Classic Movies section that has a lot of Criterion stuff and this, you know, foreign film, just all kinds of stuff. It's been a lot to sort of get through. But is there something off to start that you have sort of, you know, a series of things or a TV series where you've sort of dove back in and you're you know, devouring, or is it just random, all kinds of random stuff?
Well, yeah, a bunch of different things happen. My wife, who was working from home the entire time, she is a fan of The Facts of Life and many other things that, you know, I don't understand, but like she would watch two or three Facts of Life a day, and it's just like you'd hear that music and go, oh, I'm not going up there. I like it to a point, but I don't understand. Mm-hmm. Like, her favorite era of Facts of Life is when the show is just creatively bankrupt, like completely creatively, but like Edna Garrett has left the show and
just Joe.
Yeah,
Joe's the
no,
only
it's
left.
It's like Beverly Ann years and there's some sort of joy / schadenfreude as she gets out of that, and she just finds it funny. And she has, my wife is a very big fan of irony, but even that I gotta tap out, you know. But then she got into Community again, Dan Harmon's Community.
Oh, yeah.
And during that time, I had been addicted to Harmontown for like 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
Which was weird because it was like, you know, watching Community with a fresh set of eyes and realizing that, like, you know, this is Dan Harmon's psychoses being laid out on a series, right? Like, Joel McHale's character is basically an avatar for him.
Yeah,
and you're just sitting there going like, oh, but it's still one of the best written comedies of the last few years.
Yeah, it's great.
And I watched. I can't remember what I was. Was it It Crowd or Toast?
Okay.
Oh, I watched a bunch of It Crowds and Toast because I'm a Matt Berry fan. And I would also pick up the odd What We Do in the Shadows.
That show, I think, has just been stunning.
Yeah, but I've been, like, only, like, good shows like Doom Patrol, as previously mentioned, I think, in our last episode. It's like chocolate-covered cherries. I only want to have, like, one. you know, and then like I'll go back in 2 weeks and watch another one. And I'm positive that I haven't been watching What We Do in the Shadows in any sort of sequential order, and I don't care. But it is so fun.
It's so good.
But so you know, good. I've gone all over the place. You know, I started rewatching things I own. Like I picked up. I have Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas,
mm-hmm.
which is one of my favorites. Which is weird because when I saw it in the theater, I wanted to leave.
But, oh really?
Yeah. That's interesting. It was the really bad energy in the theater. People okay. were just storming out, and now I understand where I was coming from at the time,
mm-hmm.
but yeah, it's grown to be one of my favorite movies. And what was the other one I watched? I started taping classic movies that were playing because we got like channels, free previews would come in and out, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one of them was Fletch. Which I haven't watched probably in about 10 years.
Oh, okay. The original 85.
Chevy Chase Fletch. Chevy Chase Fletch Lives.
Okay.
Which I was like alone in a theater for Fletch Lives. I remember that when it first came out. 'Cause I was such a huge Chevy Chase fan, and it was like, oh, this doesn't look good. that movie still really holds up for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's there's some stuff that wouldn't fly in there these days, but really,
yeah.
really enjoyed that. And then what happened with me was I started kind of falling down a rabbit hole. Like, you'd order DVDs,
mm-hmm.
and the biggest problem was, you know, Canada, we were locked down like crazy in Ontario,
mm-hmm.
and everybody's ordering from Amazon. And I remember somebody from Canada Post saying something to the point of, it's Christmas times two here, so your mail's going to be spotty like crazy.
Okay.
Now they've hired so many people that like last night when I was like just before I went to bed, my wife said, "Oh, then you know, the neighbors have these really cool solar lights, and they sent over the link where to get them on Amazon." And I
mm-hmm.
in bed, I'm 10 o'clock at night. I grabbed my phone and I went, "All right, order with Prime, blah." I have those now. They're
oh, wow.
in my home now.
Oh, wow.
Like, I don't know how that happened. but I waited weeks for Kung Fu movies. Like, I'm a big fan of Kung Fu movies. And I ordered a bunch. And the one I recently got, and this took a while because I bought it used, was Five Fingers of Death. Which is
oh, yeah.
believed to be the one that started the Kung Fu craze.
Did you just talk about... Did this just come up? Did you mention this last time?
I posted it on Facebook yeah. when I got it.
Maybe that was...
And my neighbor very cleverly said something to the point of, no, it's four fingers and a thumb of death, you know.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it.
Okay.
I thought... that it would, you know, like sometimes Kung Fu movies, like I'm a big fan, but sometimes they're crappy or sometimes I just don't resonate with them. Like, there's certain movies people consider classics and I kind of like don't dig them.
Mm-hmm.
But this one actually worked for me on every level. I enjoyed the hell out of it.
And okay.
That was actually a really nice change of pace for me, is that
okay.
I was actually emotionally involved with an old Kung Fu movie, which is...
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I was quite pleased with. And of course, the big highlight... You know, like I was buying like one DVD a month or one Blu-ray a month during my layoff. And
mm-hmm.
the other one I'm really pleased I got was Danger Diabolic.
Oh, yeah.
I love that movie.
Classic.
And I only have it on VHS.
Oh,
so
okay.
It was time for an upgrade. Fantastic score by Morricone, who just recently.
Does it have
away.
The? I've got a Region 2 copy that has. It has like a little mini doc, I think, and it's got the interview Mike D or somebody from the Beastie mm-hmm. Boys. Is that on there?
It's Do you have that, it on there? Yeah, it's got the whole okay. body moving thing.
Yeah. Okay.
Which I think is wonderful, and you know, that's a movie that, like, I adore it. and I think it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that that was the last episode of Mystery Science Theater also works for me.
Like, see,
you can look at it from different angles, and I don't have a problem with it whatsoever.
Well, no, but again, it's that, and this is, you know where I come from with this stuff. I dig this stuff. I don't dig it like you do, the Mystery Science type thing. But for me, it's like when the movie came out and it was This Island Earth, that's to me what the turn was, where it was like, oh, okay, so we're going to make fun of anything. Like, we're going to take whatever it is, because you can do that to Star Wars. You can do it to The Godfather. You can do that sort of thing. The initial vibe I always thought of the thing was, you know, Plan 9 from Outer Space. We're in on the joke, and it's also ridiculous that, and that was the charm to me. And yeah, it's just that, so the diabolic thing was, to me, was like, oh, I think it's much better than, because we can still do that. If you were here and we were watching it together, we could like take shots and, you know, change.
That's where I kind of like, I think some things are better suited for the Mystery Science Theater than others.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get a movie that's so incredibly bad that it brings you down. You know what I mean? Like, there's a few movies that they've tried to do that are, they're just boring, or they're dreary and terrible. And,
or it's just like a sad, you realize somebody got people together and they got a camera and they made this thing. And it's like mental illness. Like you're watching mental illness.
And one of the things that gets me about Diabolik though, is that it does have, it does have its kind of own cartoon logic and its own like, if you look at it, and I think that's the beauty. Like, there's someone who says, you know, a lot of people unfairly compared it to the 66 Batman as being campy, except that it's not in the same league at all, because I don't think anyone is playing it for camp. You know, the film does have camp elements.
And that's where I always, you know, with something like Diabolik, Dino De Laurentiis, you know, executive producing it and all that stuff, the comic book thing. Well, I do kind of bring it back to Flash Gordon and go,
oh yeah,
well, this is where De Laurentiis's head was. You know, he saw, you know, he didn't know much about Lorenzo Semple Jr. He'd worked with him, you know, he knew the Batman series, but you know, he probably took it more on face value than the winking that America did. And so I think that when you come to Flash Gordon, you look at Diabolik, you're like, that's for real. Like that's the through that lens of what these movies were and what these properties were, you know, it was kind of far out like that. And I think it sort of bled over into Flash Gordon. Now, he, you know, Semple put things in the script that were definitely winking at the audience, but I think there's a lot of stuff that's happening in Flash Gordon that the Europeans and the Italians that were sort of involved with it were thinking differently. They weren't seeing the tongue in cheek stuff that some of the cast were and what America sort of did.
I think. Well, there is some really good jokes written into Flash Gordon.
Yeah. And Diabolik to me too. The interesting thing about that is like, that's sadly something that not a lot of people have seen and know. And I think it's only because it's not a character that anybody knows in this country.
Yeah.
But just a select few have any idea what this is. Did you ever talk about Modesty Blaze? Did you ever watch, have you ever seen Modesty Blaze?
Yeah, I have.
Well, no, I'm not, I don't think it's a great movie. It's just, it's one of those, it's from that same kind of era.
Unfortunately, it got really, there was an interview, I believe, with Milk and Cheese creator, Evan Dorkin and his wife, Sarah Dyer, and they went on and on about Modesty Blaze being just awesome and hilarious and fantastic. Uh-huh. And I ran out and bought a frickin' copy. And I couldn't sit through it. And I remember
I look at it just like the thing I said about Life Force and the way they broke it down. It's like, I think it's Joseph Losey, I think, is the director of that, maybe. And Dirk Bogarde and Terrence Stamp. And somebody else, you know, Monica Vitti, I think, is the lead. But it's like all this madness, this great, you know, very, very mod, you know, aesthetic and theme tune and everything. It doesn't really work. No, but it's something that I kind of like as a thing that sort of, you know, there was something brewing at the time and that sort of popped up. But again, nobody in this country knows who the hell Modesty Blaze is. Like, no. it never it wouldn't be the kind of thing. Speaking of, okay, let's go back a bit. So I'm going to say, now you mentioned Doom Patrol. The new season has started a few weeks ago, and I love this freaking show so much that I went back and I started rewatching season one.
Yeah.
And it is, I really, you know, if you dig it, I would really recommend, if you have the time, to watch it a second time, because it just, now I'm just letting it flow. That first time was kind of just this, did he really say that? Is this really, is this what's happening? Are we going right, you know? And I was so sort of tickled by the whole thing. Now you kind of see how beautifully all the pieces fit together and how well this thing is laid out over the course of a season.
Yeah, and I did such a bad job of watching it. And in fact, I snuck out the finale without telling my wife.
Oh,
and I probably did it like late at night. And probably you gotta go back. Yeah, and I don't remember, like when we put on season two, episode one.
Yeah.
And my wife goes, oh, we're just starting the second season. You finished it without me? And I was like, oh, this is going
great. You do yourself a favor and go back, because
it watched the first 15 minutes and I turned it off because I didn't remember anything.
Yeah. You should, because there's stuff that's popping into a couple of these episodes that I remember, but now I'm really sort of taking it in, like when they first go to the street, to Danny the Street and stuff like that. And also in between, I've managed to get, because I'd read some of the Grant Morrison stuff in the 90s, but I got a trade paperback of some of his, like the first volume, and I started reading some of that, and so I'm just kind of going to it again with fresh eyes. But the other thing too is the cast on the show is fantastic. I'm going to get their names wrong, but I think her name is Diana Herrero or Guerrero. Herrero is Jane. A woman.
Oh, I love her. Yeah.
April Bowlby is playing Rita.
Rita, you know, the last.
And they are fantastic. I mean, Jane has got 64 personalities and stuff, and she is acting her face off. And Rita is great. Dalton is, you know, one of my acting heroes, and then Brendan Fraser, who you mainly, you know, get in a voice, but he's fantastic. The VO stuff is just like, he is 1,000%. And the same thing for my heterosexual life partner, Matt Bomer, who is, you know, too handsome. There's such a thing as being too handsome. And I think Matt Bomer might fit into that category.
You mean but he's, John Boy?
Exactly. He's mainly, vocal work as well. And he's terrific. And when he's on camp, it's great.
I liked the Doom Patrol comics growing up. I had a digest of them when I was a kid, and I remember they really appealed to me, just the old 60s ones and how weird they were. And they were really well-written comics. And also, I liked the Doom Patrol more than the X-Men, to be perfectly honest with you.
When you said weird, and that's a great word, it never feels like... The oddness and the weirdness to it is very matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
They never hit you over the head. It's just you go, this is where we're going now. This is the thing that I'm talking about in the story. You either come with or you don't. But the other thing that's great about telling you what this thing is and you know, dissecting the hell of it. It's just like, this is what it is. And as the audience, you got to go, yeah, okay, that makes as much sense as anything else that's just happened.
Well, you do kind of get Robot Cliff being your everyman.
Yes, and he's so angry. He's just so angry all the time, and he's hilarious.
The episode with the Nazis was one of my favorites. Just that, because
the Danny the Street and because it starts with the whole group therapy thing.
Yeah, you know,
Cliff wanted we should sit down and have group therapy, and it is, and also it's also very, very funny.
Yeah,
I mean it's very funny. You know, and I'm really digging the second season, which I won't say anything about. So that's what I'm kind of as you know, I got to, you know, being in isolation and you know, being in Los Angeles, of course, I'm very adept at this point. And I know, just like you said, not to sit and do, you know, Doom Patrol all day or 2 days straight. You got to do an episode and a half, maybe two, and then move on to something in this other pile. Then maybe go over to the DVD pile, then try to get 10 minutes of news and then come back. So I've got my lists here on Prime, And there were a couple things that were in here that I was going to ask you about. Some stuff is just so like, you know, I kind of have heard of this thing, but not. This one I'm dying to watch, and I have not watched it yet. It's called Red Sun. Do you know this movie? 1971?
1971.
Well, and it says 71. It might be 74, but here's the tagline. Charles Bronson, Alain Delon, and Toshiro Mifune join forces in this intriguing adventure as a gunslinger, bandit, and warrior in pursuit of a valuable stolen Japanese sword.
I've heard of this. I've okay. never seen it. It's got Ursula Andress in it, too.
Just sign me up. I don't care. I'm watching.
Damn,
this.
I wonder if my Prime has that. That's enough. I bought NordVPN, and I was hoping it would get me like into Amazon Prime, and Amazon's the one that's like, no, we know it's you, Brian. And
but you have a lot. Don't you have a lot of the same? Don't you have?
Yeah, but there's like Canadian laws and rights, and it's all over the place. And sometimes that benefits me. Like sometimes like I get Doom Patrol on my cable, whereas I don't have to pay for HBO Max.
I
don't get Red Sun. No.
Okay, so there's that one, and then this one I also put aside, which I have not watched yet, but I guarantee you know it, and or maybe a fan. Beyond Atlantis.
Yeah, I might be a fan. I think I have that on Blu-ray. Let me just see.
I think you do.
Almost definitely. Yeah, that is an Eddie Romero film, and I have a pact in this life, and that is to buy every movie that has Eddie Romero or not Eddie Romero, Vic Diaz in it. Vic Diaz is this fantastic actor. The Quentin Tarantino calls him the Filipino Peter Lorre, and I learned who Vic Diaz was when I was like a teenager because you know Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, and mm-hmm. she would play all these Hemisphere Blood Island movies, which I love, and mm-hmm. I became kind of obsessed with Filipino made movies, and that is, you know, that's a John Ashley classic. It's got Patrick Wayne. I think Sid Haig's in it.
See?
Yeah, I own that on Blu-ray, dude.
Throw in Atlantis, and I'm in. Yeah. And speaking of these kinds of movies, and I don't know if we've talked about this, but you know, one of the interesting things about Prime too is that not every time, but I'd say about 60-70% of the time, when you go to click on a title, it'll give you the option to watch the trailer.
Yeah.
It's an old movie, let's say. Sometimes they don't have a trailer, and so what they've done is pop on, you know, 3 minutes of the opening of the movie or 2 minutes of some random scene or whatever. But when it comes to things that you sort of don't recognize, there is always a crapshoot because sometimes it's like, okay, that looks like it could be an interesting little horror film, or I'm going to click on this trailer and it's going to be somebody with their iPhone in someone's basement and it's just...
Oh, yeah, that's the problem with a lot of that stuff.
So this happened with these documentaries that I watched the trailer and I went, if this is as good as this trailer, and they're called Time Warp, there's three of them. There's three volumes. The greatest cult films of all time. There's volume one, volume two, and volume three. They're brand new from 2020. The first one is about horror. The second one is about just cult things like, you know, Buckaroo Banzai or whatever. And the third one is about, I believe, comedies. You know, comedies didn't do much. No, I take it back. The first one is maybe about cult. I forget, but Lebowski's in there. All these things that didn't work when they first came out and then built up an audience. There are four hosts, which is so strange. There's four hosts sitting in director's chairs coming back from clips. And it's John Waters, Joe Dante, Kevin Pollak, and what's her name? Damn it. Here's the date.
Where is this? Because I can't find it.
It's called Time Warp, the greatest cult films of all time, is what it's called.
Hmm.
And I watched the first two, and they were great. But the four of them sort of give commentary, although Kevin Pollak has barely spoken in two of these that I've watched. But, you know, John Waters tells his stories about his stuff, and Joe Dante talks about he's, you know, and they all kind of do a little roundtable in between clips and stuff. But there's some great interviews. Like, they got, you know, they got Jeff Goldblum to, you know, to talk about Buckaroo Banzai, you know, like wherever they grabbed him. And it looks, you know, it's pretty well shot. So it's fairly well done. But if you can find it, it's a interesting little excursion. The other one that I put aside that I have not watched, have you seen the Electric Boogaloo one about Canon Films?
Oh, yeah, a couple times. I've also watched the Go-Go Boys as well. I would highly suggest watching both.
Okay. What's the Go-Go Boys?
The Go-Go Boys, when somebody was making the Electric Boogaloo, it did not escape the gaze of Menachem and I can't remember the other guy's name. Golan Globus. And Globus, they made their own documentary. And it's actually quite well done. And it's sort of like both sides of the story.
Okay.
And I think the Electric Boogaloo is an excellent documentary, but it kind of cartoons these guys a little bit. You know, they kind of makes fun of them.
I saw the trailer and I was like, if this is just going to be a total piss take for 90 minutes, like, I'm not sure.
It's a fun piss take, but okay. The Go-Go Boys is more humanizing. You know, it isn't an ego fest. It isn't like Mr. Burns made a film, but it humanizes them a little bit. And
okay, all right.
I liked both very, I highly recommend if you watch that one, you should watch the other one. You won't be bored.
Well, I'll tell you what one of them got me to do is I had a copy of Rocky Horror Picture Show on Blu-ray that had been sitting around forever, and you know, it's one of those things that, like, you know, it's so familiar now to as a cult thing that, you know, I hadn't seen it in, I don't know, 15 years, 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those things that, like, I eventually, you know, many, many, many years ago, went to one of the midnight things just to experience it kind of thing.
Yeah, I did that.
And I think I just kind of went, I'm done. But the clips that they showed, I went, I know I have a copy of this. And I sat and watched it one night. And it was so good. It is such a good movie. It is so, you know...
Yeah.
Because it's bonkers. Again, it's one of those things that's absolutely bonkers. It was this little stage show that they made into a movie that got trashed and did not make a dime and somehow made it into another realm and became this cultural, you know, thing. But the songs are great. The songs are right in that sweet spot of, you know, glam and rock and roll in the early 70s, mid 70s that I dig, that they're heavier, they're just of that time. And Tim Curry is just,
yeah,
I mean, he's astounding.
I've never gotten it.
It's never been my thing. It's just that sometimes there are those things that are out there that are so prevalent that you go,
I understand what you're saying. You
come back and give it a look and you go, this is not, you know, there are things out there that I go, I don't get it. You're welcome to it. But this, I kind of get why. I don't get why people still dress up and go to the thing. I don't get cosplay, frankly, but that's, you know, that's down to whoever. But as just a thing, if it was just a thing that never had that following, I'd still go, that is a one-off. That is a strange movie.
It's a moment in time that it's lightning in a bottle. You can't replicate that. And so many people did try to make another Rocky Horror Picture Show.
What was the one they did afterwards? Was it Shock
Treatment? But Treatment. If you remember, there's one called The Return of Captain Invincible. I rented that once. It's got Alan Arkin, I think, in it, and there's actually a song called Bullshit, where a guy's just going bullshit, 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 and you're like, what is this? Like, they were just trying to make it weird to get an audience. They didn't realize that you have to have some sort of authenticity to it.
Yes.
Like, whatever Rocky Horror Picture Show is, and I don't get it, those people going to it do get it. Like, it speaks to them, and it has an authentic voice. And, you know, maybe it's the outsiderism, maybe it's just the letting go. But, that's the one thing I do understand about it is that its audience gets it.
Yeah, and it's just, it's bonkers. And when Tim Curry shows up, it's one of those things that's just like, he's absolutely fearless. I mean, this was his first movie, and he just, he's just, you know, he doesn't care. Like, it's just like, I don't care what, you know, it's just for the performance, that thing, that elevates it to me. The performance, his performance elevates
Unlike
it.
Screenings of, like, The Room, which I've been to and stuff, the audience isn't laughing at the movie. Like, the audience at a Room screening, they are fucking laughing at the movie. But the audience at a Rocky Horror Picture Show aren't laughing at a movie. They're having fun. And,
Totally. Yeah. That's a great example, is the Room, of being something that became this thing that you know, everybody's in. You know, it's kind of sad in a way, but it is what it is. But this is something else, and it was nice to look at something that I hadn't seen in such a long time, that it was familiar to me. It wasn't overly familiar.
I really find interesting is when you go see a movie that you adore, a cult movie that, you know, you don't know anyone else that loves it. and then you go to see it with an audience, and how they react can be really interesting. I was a humongous, and still am a humongous fan of Sonny Chiba's Street Fighter films.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched them, you know, in the 80s and 90s. And then a friend of mine said, hey, they're playing at this little tiny theater. Do you want to go? And I said, oh, hell yeah. Like, you know, Saturday night, let's go. And I drove downtown. And the audience was killing themselves laughing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going like, oh, my God, these are kind of, like, silly and over the top. And it was like, you know, it was a complete eye opener for me, to be perfectly honest with you, because I've always loved them, you know, and but I was totally okay with that. And it was the same.
Okay. No, but it's interesting, because I think I've told you this once before, and that's, I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, a lot of stuff we talk about is cult and degrees of it, and everybody's experience of, you know, a movie or a show, whatever, is everybody's own experience. But, you know, I used to go to the New Beverly, like, especially when I first moved out here. I had like a shitty VCR, and I was living in a studio before I had a one bedroom. And, you know, I'd go with a couple of buddies, and for $5, it was a double feature, and they had like these kosher hot dogs, you know, and shitty popcorn and stuff. So that was a huge part of my life, like when I first came out to LA, and then sporadically for different events and stuff. And I will never forget going to a screening of Planet of the Apes.
Cool.
And this must have been like 1998, 97 or 98 or so. And from the moment Heston opens his mouth, the audience is laughing its ass off.
No way.
And I'm looking at my buddy going, what the fuck? Like, what's... And it kept going and going. And then it just was, you know, it was like everything was a double entendre somehow, or everything sort of had another, like, winky meaning at the audience. Kind of thing. And it was like they went to see it because it was so silly. Because the dialogue was so silly and he was so stiff and whatever. And I went, what's going on here? Like, that was the first time I can recall something that I loved, like being treated that way, kind of. And I went, okay, if this is the new world, you know, it's not my bag. It's like, we can all make fun of shit and make jokes about it and stuff, but you can't just, you can't poke everything.
No,
because it's just the nothing special. You know what I mean?
In the mid-90s, I went to go a double feature of Plan 9 and then Ed Wood. And I absolutely loved Ed Wood to pieces. Oh, so, and my girlfriend hadn't seen it at the time. So, like, I had seen it without her. And so we went to go see it. And I remember there was a woman... In the line, this woman's energy was upsetting me. You know, like just she. There was. Do you ever hear that musical Forever Plaid?
Have I?
Yeah,
I was in the touring company in '98.
Okay, well then you'll know her. She was wearing a Forever Plaid jacket.
I hate her already.
And whenever
I'm kidding.
Somebody, you know, like one of her friends came and. She mentioned she'd seen it like 50 times, and it's like, oh.
Was she wearing an O Calcutta jacket?
No, that there's no jacket for O Calcutta.
Nice.
You just take a magic marker and write it on your back. you know, even in the line, she was annoying me, but I'm a grumpy bastard, anyways. Even at 23, I was kind of old man Hyler. But
it was slipping away.
She started mouthing off Plan 9 in the theater. And I remember going like, I think I finally just yelled, "Nobody needs your comments."
Ooh.
Because it was like, that movie doesn't, you don't need to make fun of that movie. It is making fun of itself. It is hitting itself over the head. And you know, she stopped. And, because it was just, for me, it was like, the Plan 9, I don't even think you should riff tracks or Mystery Science Theater Plan 9, because as much as it's called the worst movie ever made, it is one of the most entertaining things I've ever seen.
And well, it's
backwards entertaining, you know.
It's kind of like, I've always tried to figure out where, you know, the term camp or the term, you know, that whatever that vein is you want to call it, it's such a strange thing, or it's sort of like the when did the awareness start? And you look at something like Plan 9 or any of the stuff that he did, and that's what made Mystery Science Theater so appealing to me. Yeah. You know, when it's is that, for better or worse, These people were giving it their all, and they thought they were making something good or decent, or maybe they didn't think they were making an epic, but they were doing something. And then something like, you know, whatever happened to Baby Jane comes along. And if you've ever seen that, you're like, now they had to know, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they knew what they were doing when they made this, that this was over the top exploitation.
Absolutely.
You know, and it becomes a different thing. And so it's like, we can all look at any performance of, I mean, Charlton Heston plays a Mexican in Touch of Evil, for God's sake. It's one of the greatest movies ever made. And you've got to sort of get over the fact that he's in dark makeup, and he's certainly not even attempting an accent, but it is what it is. Like, you can chip away at any Heston performance, but that's not really, You wouldn't have in 1972 or whatever, you know, it was, or 68 or whatever the movie, whatever movie.
Well, he just entered the pop culture zeitgeist so much that people impersonated him, and you know, it became that thing, you know, like they're not laughing at Charlton Heston in Planet of the Apes. I think they're laughing at like Bill Hartman doing Charlton Heston.
Yeah, it
you
could,
know what I mean?
It like, could be. It could be, yeah. And it's different because, like, you know, you look at the Looney Tunes and, you know, stuff that we used, a lot of sketch stuff we grew up with. Bogart, Cagney, always these impressions, Jimmy Stewart. They were impressions, but it was never like really making fun of the era or the entire thing of like, oh my God, I can't believe they wrote dialogue like that back then or whatever.
Yeah.
This was what it was. But something did happen, you know, in the late 90s or so, where it started to happen with a lot of stuff. And it's certainly, you can do it with anything. I just feel like if you don't draw a line or you don't embrace, you know, stuff at a certain point, then you just sort of, everything is.
The thing I wanted to get to at that Plan 9 Ed Wood screening was, after watching Plan 9, Ed Wood became 10 times funnier to the audience. The audience was howling because it was referencing the movie they had just seen.
Oh, that's funny.
And I remember, because I'd seen it twice in the theater, and the first time I saw it in the theater, the audience was very receptive. It was, you know, I still think it's a fantastic, almost perfect movie.
It's brilliant, that movie. It is so, every scene, and Johnny Depp is freaking fantastic.
Yeah, I haven't said that in a long time, but yeah, I agree.
To be fair, there's a lot of performances that he did up to a certain point that are very, very good. And he still might have it if he puts the ketamine down. He might still have hope
for him. I still think
I do too.
I do too. I don't think it's a lost cause.
So let me just get this out, because I don't think you like horror, but you don't really dig new horror as much, correct?
No, in fact, if I see stuff that says 2020 on Amazon Prime, I know that's filmed on someone's phone, and I have no interest in that whatsoever. And
well, I'm just going to say this. There's a movie I came across on Netflix the other night that I had never heard of, did not know existed. And when I looked the director up, I realized I already seen like three of his movies, and they're all great. and I can't think of his name. I wish I could. But it's a movie called The Ritual. It's called The Ritual. And it's on Netflix. I think it's from 2018 or 2019. Four guys in the woods going on a camping trip. And that's all I'm going to say. And I was so knocked out by this thing. It is a strange movie. It is scary.
My wife watched it. I remember.
Oh, she did?
Yeah, and I watched about half of it. But I was in and out because, you know, like, okay. I work in the basement.
It is so good. And then you're going, where is this going? What the hell is this? And it starts to kind of take a turn. And I love when something comes out of nowhere and you're like surprised by something, or you watch a great comedy or a great action thing or something. And it's like, oh, that's, you know, that was a nice, I'm glad I stumbled across that, you know, for 90 minutes or whatever. And that's another thing that all of this streaming shit does very well. So I've been watching another show. Do you know about a show called Man in a Suitcase?
No, I haven't heard of that one.
This is an interesting show that I know very little about, but I've started to watch it. And it is from that same era that ITC, you know, Lou Grade type shows, you know, with all the Gerry Anderson stuff and the Champions and things like that. And it's a show about a guy that's like a former, I think he's former CIA or something, but he's been disgraced somehow. And you kind of learn as you go. Starring Richard Bradford. Richard Bradford, I think most people would know him. Later on, he became sort of a character actor, and he's probably best known for the Irish cop that fights Sean Connery in the alleyway in The Untouchables. So when you see him, you go, oh, so this is what he did as a young man. But it's an interesting show because I was reading about it, and he basically takes an assignment each episode. And it's a strange show that's very different than the stuff of that era, and it's more gritty. Like, when he gets beat up, he really gets beat up, you know, and if he's going to hurt somebody, he really hurts somebody. And apparently they courted this guy for a while to do this show. And he's American. It's everyone else in the thing is British. He's American for, you know, the bigger markets and stuff. And he sort of had to be convinced because he was like, I'm not going to do this. Roger Moore punches a guy, you know, and he beats everybody up. Like, it's going to be realistic. And so it's been an interesting, because I don't really know much about it in that realm of shows. So that's and Jason King. And I pulled out my box set of Jason King, and I'm diving back into that. And then I came across something that because we had been talking about Nigel Neal.
Yeah.
And we talked about Quatermass and
Halloween 3, I think, is where that came from.
Yes, that was it. That was it. And how he really became sort of the godfather of British, you know, sci-fi type stuff, you know, on television. He did 1984, the 1984 adaptation before Quatermass. Quatermass was huge. He did this other thing that I found on YouTube that I wanted to tell you about called The Stone Tapes. And it's from the early 70s, and it's about this team of, like, Ghostbuster type people that set up all this equipment that know this castle is supposed to be haunted, and they're going to try to sort of document it. And that's up on YouTube, along with all of Blake 7, by the way, is up on YouTube.
Yeah, so I got to get back into that. I know you wanted to do that as an episode, and it's like, I really need to rewatch it.
Well, I figured you would, because I got to tell you, I've only seen a handful of these, and so I started watching.
Yeah.
Been watching season one, and was just like, "What? This is you know, it's an interesting."
I got hooked on it in the 80s, and then I moved, and I didn't have cable where I was living, and I was like, "I guess I'm not watching anymore Blake 7, or Sylvester McCoy Doctor Who's." But yeah,
I'm not even sure if I remember it being on. You know, on the
it was
Friday.
On YTV here in Canada.
I don't know if they had it on public 80s. Television, along with all the Doctor Who stuff that they used to do on public television. But so I've been watching that. But I found
man,
a copy of a show, a one-off show that Nigel Neal did in 1967 or 68, called The Year of the Sex Olympics.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that. That's famous, yeah.
And it is fantastic. It is, it, and the reason it's famous, without, if anybody finds it, because I couldn't find it other than this shitty DVD, Brian Cox is in it. Leonard Rossiter is in it, who is
Brian Cox Fallen is in The Year of Sex Olympics.
Leonard Rossiter, who was in Fallen Rise of Reginald Perrin in the 70s, is in it. It's a strange show. It's a futuristic thing, sci-fi thing, but it really sort of Nigel Neal saw reality television coming from that far away.
Yeah.
And that's the stuff that's in it that you just, when you're done watching, you're like, oh my God, that's what happened 25 years later, 30 years later. That's what happened, you know? But it's as good as I'd heard that it was. So I'm glad I found that. And then of course a massive list of stuff on Prime that I'll probably never get to.
Yeah, the one thing that really crescendoed me and sent me off to a dark path is during COVID, I missed out on Severn Films' Al Adamson box set. I just kind of lost track of when that was coming out. And, you know, finding the $200 for it was a bit difficult. But luckily, somebody I know managed, when I did kind of come to my druthers, managed to get me a copy of a fellow by the name of Dan Simpson, and he also gave me some really cool comics he did and some other stuff. So I'm a huge fan of independent international films. I love Al Adamson's work, and I was lucky enough to meet him just before he was murdered. So I kind of put myself to the task of watching everything sequentially on this Blu-ray, like good or bad or things I've seen, you know, things I've seen. I would watch again with Sam Sherman, who was his producer's commentary. He's a fascinating guy. But, so I've been doing that for the last few days. And unfortunately I have to watch a lot of them in my office because of the, you know, the tons and tons of nudity in them and that sort of thing. And it's full of, like, cause I haven't seen everything in his catalog. And it's full of some really interesting surprises. And I don't know if you know this, but Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is somewhat based on an experience from Al Adamson.
It's based on an experience that he had?
Yeah. They were filming a movie, and I can't remember which movie it was, but they were filming it on the Spahn Ranch. And there's a couple of things. One, I think the stories are mixed a bit, but that Tex Watson guy, is that his name, Tex Watson?
Yeah.
He was bugging the girls. There was a movie they were filming with a lot of girls in it, and one of the stuntmen just kind of said, if you don't, you know, I'm going to kick your ass if you don't get out of here. Mm-hmm. And then people said, oh, he carries a gun. You know, and the stuntman was like, oh, that could have been told to me. But the other part of it was, and this is the more interesting part, is that one of the stuntmen, I believe his name is Anthony Bud Cardos. I'm going to mangle this. He had a broken down dune buggy. And Charles Manson said, oh, I can fix that, but I need the money up front. And he gave him the money, like $70, and said, okay, fix my dune buggy. And the next day it wasn't fixed, and this guy basically went over to Manson and said, if that isn't fixed by the end of the day, I'm going to kick your ass. And Manson fixed it. And that is, apparently that story was told to Tarantino.
Oh, no kidding.
Tarantino wrote Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and it, you know, it, there are some parallels of a, especially with, you know, when you look at like Brad Pitt's character getting a flat tire and he beats the shit out of a guy and says, mm-hmm. Fix my car.
Yeah.
That is where that comes from. It comes from Al Adamson filming a movie on the Spahn Ranch. And I think that's amazing. But also, like, I've just always been a fan. So one of the things that he would do, and this has been painful for me, is he would make a movie, not be happy with it or not find it commercially viable, and he would take pieces of it and add new pieces of it to make a new movie. And then, consequentially, he would sometimes make a third movie out of it. So by the time it's a third movie, it's kind of an incomprehensible mess. Mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated by this process. And unfortunately, Dracula versus Frankenstein started out as a movie called The Blood Seekers, I think. And then, you know, there was all these elements, and then they, midway through, or they looked at the film and said, this sucks, let's refilm it with Dracula and Frankenstein. So it's discordant. You can see what parts are where, and it's fascinating. But there is no copy of The Blood Seekers to compare it to. It's lost to time. There's a couple of movies that are completely lost to time. And on this box set, I know this is a long story, there are three movies that are the same movie. It starts off, it's called Psycho A Go-Go. Then he didn't like Psycho A Go-Go, so he changed it to The Man With The Synthetic Brain, and he added John Carradine as a mad scientist in it. And then the third part of it is... it's called Blood of Ghastly Horror, and it adds even more scenes and more cast and another plot, and apparently it's unrecognizable. So I've been trying to watch them sequentially. The only problem is that Psycho A Go-Go is one of the worst things I've ever had to watch. It's just a very flat and dull 60s movie. It's just about a jewel heist. They didn't have a soundtrack for it, so everyone's looped. And it's really obvious that, you know, like when you see movies that are looped, usually the director has the good sense to show a lot of back of heads and different things. Well, not Adamson. And then, so I sat through that and it was a chore. And then Man with a Synthetic Brain is basically that movie with just some scenes with John Carradine at it. And he's on this kind of like dollar store laboratory, you know. The brain machine is a construction helmet painted silver with wires, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm. And those scenes are actually really well shot, and there's obviously a sound man. So they look bad. It's like a beautifully filmed scene, and then you go back to the old movie, and you can kind of tell that this is, you know, pieces. And I haven't gotten to the third one because I honestly have been kind of turning it on and off every night for half an hour, mm-hmm. or so, just trying to get through it all. And I've been watching other things. He did a surprising amount of he did that average teen sex comedy. And it's called Sunset Cove, and it's barely watchable, but, you know, it would have been something I rented when I was, like, 14 and wanted to look at boobs. Mm-hmm. And he did another film called Cinderella 2000. That is something that I have never been able to sit through by him. It is a sex comedy, but it's a softcore sex comedy.
Which is weird for you, that you can't sit through a sex comedy. Yeah, I don't know what's happening.
Well, because it's not a good one.
I don't know where you went wrong. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, and despite, you know, attractive people taking their clothes off, it's I found it unbearable. But I did find the workaround in this one is that there was... I've never seen a copy with Sam Sherman commentary on it. So I was able to, you know, sit through the Sam Sherman commentary and enjoy the film a little more because he's just yammering away on facts and that sort of thing.
Speaking of naked people, do you know about this movie called Mope? Because it sounds like right up your alley. Do you know about this?
No.
It's a low budget thing, but it's about these two guys. It's based on a true story. Apparently, these two guys are desperate to break into the porn industry, and it's in L.A. And it's like a dark comedy, I guess. It's gotten good reviews, and I want to see it. But the story is that things go very bad for these two guys. And then it ends up with a murder and a samurai sword and all kinds of shit. And it looks bonkers.
Yeah.
But it's called Mope. And it's like that.
I'm looking at the poster. Fringe,
yeah. It's like a fringe. The trailer was great. But it's like this fringe, ultra low budget porn stuff. You know, it looks like maybe it's supposed to be early 80s or something.
Hmm.
But I wasn't sure if you knew about it because
I recognize that one of the actors is the Ask Google guy.
There's
the shorts. His name's Brian Husky. He's in a lot of comedy shorts. Yeah.
Yes. Do you know about the Susie Q documentary too about Susie Quattro?
No.
Did you see that?
No, I would watch that in a heartbeat.
Yeah, because that's up your alley too.
Oh, sure.
It's just called Susie Q. It's for rental right now. It just sort of hit, I think maybe a month ago or so. I sometimes go down the documentary road where I'm just kind of, whether it's YouTube or any of the stuff that we're talking
about. Documentaries. I just watched one on Jose Mejica Moran's or Coffin Joe.
Yeah, there's some that you kind of, it's hard to, sometimes I can turn them off in 15 minutes or so if I go, okay, they don't have anybody. They're not going to be talking. There was one that was about Kubrick. He was like Kubrick's assistant or something, you know. And at one point, we're following him to a storage unit to take a, you know, look at papers, to talk to the camera and stuff. Like, no one else is going to be in this thing. And I go, okay, maybe I'll wait on this one. But, you know, like the Paul Williams one I thought was good. I thought the guy doing it was a little insufferable. But I thought
actually, that one kind of bugged me. It was too much personality there.
Yeah, too much. Too much about this is my story kind of thing. It's like, just do the fucking documentary and talk about stuff, you know?
Well, the one that got, I recently watched one that was like free on YouTube, and it was a Hunter S. Thompson documentary, but it wasn't the one that made the theater circuit a few years ago. I can't remember the name of that one, but I actually own that. Gonzo.
I watched a great one. I think it was on YouTube too. It was about Philip K. Dick.
Oh yeah.
And it was from maybe the mid-90s or so. And, man, talk about a bonkers life. Like, just a very strange life. Some things I certainly didn't know about.
Heard a little bit about him.
Eating horse meat and stuff like that. Like, it's where he got his food. At the pet store, he'd eat horse meat for, you know, when he was poor and stuff. Just strange stuff. But I love that shit. And then... there was another show that I started getting back into, and now I forgot what it was. You know, I've been watching too is The Muppet Show. I had some DVDs of The Muppet Show that I haven't, and I bet I haven't seen these since they aired.
Yeah.
And that's another show that's just like, I know everybody loves The Muppets, but that was really a big show. Like, when we were kids, Saturday night, 7 o'clock, whatever it was.
Yeah, it was usually around 7 o'clock. Yeah.
Freaking glued. And I found, because I was watching some, I found a documentary. It was at, you know, it was post, you know, after Henson had died. It was on YouTube somewhere. And just the background and just how no one in America went for the show, but the UK, again, Lou Grade, I believe, said, I'll make your show.
Yeah, I think and I talked about this in our last isolation one, but the Defunctland guys do an amazing Henson documentary.
The who does? Sorry?
Defunct Land.
Defunct Land? Is that a YouTube thing?
YouTube channel. The main topics of Defunct Land are Disney World attractions that failed or are no longer, other park attractions and parks that failed. And then he gets into this brilliant Henson documentary as well that I was riveted to be perfectly honest with you.
Okay, I'll look that up.
Yeah,
did we talk about the show Voyagers? What? The last time we talked, did I tell you that I found Voyagers? I bought
like the John Eric Hexum Mino the Police John show,
the John Eric Hexum show from 1982-83. Do you remember that show?
Oh, yeah, I absolutely. I just said John Eric Hexum and Mino Police.
Well, I mean, did you watch
Phineas Bogg?
Yes. Did you watch?
I watched every episode.
Oh, you did. Okay, because it's again. Not something I have seen since it aired, but I remember, being, 11 or 12 or whatever it was. And there wasn't a lot of genre stuff on TV. And this was kind of a big show. And, of course you see every familiar face you can think of in that Love Boat, Fantasy Island,
I never forgot the episode because I was watching it with my mom as a kid, and my mom was always one of these people that kind of was like Mystery Science Theater, living.
Yeah, with it, I was going to make fun of the Rock.
She's very sarcastic. Never took anything too seriously, we were watching, and they land in the Roman era, and of course the Romans are all talking, and she goes, "Wow, they're really English." Like,
Mom.
They all have British accents. Why do Romans all have British accents?
And jeez,
Mom. It was like throwing a hammer through a plate glass window. I could never not hear that,
Yeah.
It was just one of those things.
Did you know that when that horrible thing happened to John Eric Hexum?
Yeah, on Cover Up. Yeah.
That he said, you know, he put the gun to his temple and pulled the trigger.
Yeah.
And there was a blank in there or something, and I think it permeated the temple or something, and he had a hemorrhage or whatever. He was dating Dottie from Pee-wee's Big Adventure at the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were boyfriend girlfriend.
What's her name? She was like a singer too.
Well, she ended up. She was in Valley Girl, I think, and she was one of the Powerpuff Girls.
Wasn't she?
She said her name.
The singer in. I swear she's in Better Off Dead.
She might be. Yeah, she might be.
What's her name?
I don't know why I can't think of her damn name. They were dating. And so the scene in Pee-wee's Big Adventure when he passes out in the bike shop, that is the day after she got the phone call, or 2 days after she got the phone call or something. And when they come in, they like put him on a stretcher to take him out. She started to break down because it was reminding her of everything. And
oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, they were boyfriend girlfriend at the time.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out if.
Now, what's her name? E.G. Daily.
E.G. Daily, yeah.
Daily, yes.
And if she isn't Better Off Dead. Thank you.
She's Better Off Dead, huh?
Yeah, she sings the theme song at their prom.
Oh, jeez. I wouldn't, yeah. Okay.
Better Off Dead than to live without you. I'm not going to sing that for you.
Keep going.
No.
Keep going.
You've got enough from me.
I would also like to say that I've mentioned it many times, but Lodge 49 is streaming as well, I believe, on Hulu. If no one has gotten to it and you appreciate our opinions, I would highly recommend it. Did you ever see any of Constantine? Remember the NBC show Constantine?
Nah, I can't stand the dude.
You don't like the guy that played Constantine?
I don't like Dick Van Dyke, no. I know he's Welsh.
But oh, he's Welsh. He's British. He's Welsh.
He's Welsh, but he's doing like the "Oh, I've got a lovely bunch of coconut." Like I cannot handle.
It's not that bad. I'm a real like, stickler for this shit.
Like it's chewing not, glass for me.
It's not great, but it's not that bad.
Like his weird, like yeah, he looks exactly like the comic character. But it's almost to, like, the Popeye level of authenticity. You know how, like, the characters in Popeye are just a little too on the nose? They're a little weird looking.
You're talking about the movie, Popeye?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, like, yeah.
You know, no, like...
You don't want to compare anything to the movie Popeye, because right out the door, right out the gate, it is not going to be a good comparison.
I love Popeye.
Talk about great. Nails on the chalkboard. Popeye is... I tried watching it a couple years ago, and it is... I saw it in the theater, and I was like nine or ten. I fell asleep.
No.
It was so fucking... It was... Oh, my God. I begged my mom. I said, can we go see The Elephant Man next week? And so the next week, we went to see The Elephant Man at the same theater because I was so drained from Popeye. The quote... And I love Nielsen. The quote, songs... that he wrote for this movie? Oh, my God. That is...
Wait, I'm just going on Facebook. I got to unfriend Jason. Lynch.
I don't know if I can get through an entire...
Unfollow, screen. Block. Right.
But I will say this. The other thing I just found on streaming is your Hunter from the Future.
Own it on Blu-ray.
However, it's the riff tracks, your Hunter from the Future. I just want to watch your... I don't need the riff tracks, your... How many times I have seen a thing and I go, oh, they've got that streaming. And then I click on it. It's like, Riff Tracks rips the shit out of this one. Like, okay, never mind. I thought I was going to see a movie I've never seen. So there's a lot of that sort of lets me down. Like, I just want to see the damn movie. And some of this stuff is really hard to find. And that's why they've got these – and they've got some really, really strange, you know, $2 type things too that are more recent that you're like, how did this get – I know you guys need material, but like, how did this get on streaming? You got to sift through a lot of that stuff too. And then, you don't have the HBO Max thing, then, do you?
Well, there isn't. It doesn't exist in Canada.
So, but you don't have anything. Is that there's no Canadian version of that or something, like you said.
I get it on Crave, but I don't know Crave. That's our thing. That's the thing we have.
Oh, so that's where you get Doom Patrol. You said is this on Crave, but you don't know if everything that's on HBO Max is on.
No, I have no idea. I have no compass for that whatsoever.
Because that's been a huge distraction too, because they've got a whole, like I said, this Turner Classic Movie section that's got Criterion stuff and making all kinds of lists of things. I've really enjoyed the Perry Mason show on HBO, mm-hmm. which I thought was kind of refreshing. You know, it's a show that I've been trying to, just because I love anthology shows, and we did an episode on anthology shows. Have you tried any of this show, Room 104, on HBO?
No.
Man, oh man. I have tried at least 10 episodes, and it is just the biggest bunch of nothing.
Oh.
There's great talent in them and familiar faces and stuff, and then they just, I don't know quite what the point of it is. But there's a lot of, there are, thank God for all these streaming outlets and things that we can spend our time on, especially those of us that aren't particularly busy right now.
You know, I just want to bring up one movie that you asked me about modern horror, and I did watch a modern horror. I don't know if I brought it up in the last binge. I hope not. I hope I'm not repeating myself. But The Color from Space.
Yes, we talked about it briefly, I think. But
did. Okay.
Just very briefly, though. We didn't, because I think I might not have seen it when we first started to talk about it.
Yeah, I think it was like brand spanking when it came out. Now I think it is on Netflix. And it's Richard Stanley, who directed few too many films. Like, you know, I think he got fired from that Island of Dr. Moreau. And this is like his return film.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a few things that I like about it. I think it succeeds in spite of Nicolas Cage. I'm not on Team Cage. I think he's lost his marbles.
Well, see, I think when you did you see what was the one Mandy? Did you see Mandy?
Yeah, that didn't work for me.
No, it didn't. It didn't really. I didn't. I thought like I never need to see it again.
Yeah.
I got nothing against it. It was a nice piece of work. I never need to watch it again. I'm glad I saw it and I know what they were kind of going for. And to me, he's kind of it. That's what he sort of, it's that bonkers thing he does very, very well. And then sometimes you see him in something like Kick-Ass or whatever, and you go, or The Weatherman, and you go, oh shit, you know, he still can pull it out. He's still got some, you know. So you're watching Colorado Space, and it's like you're going, okay, this is, you know, now we're getting back to, and I'm without going into detail, it he sort of makes some choices where you go, okay, I'm not sure exactly what we're doing here, but he's doing something very specific that's almost a callback to something he did many, many years ago on something else. And you're kind of breaking the wall here when you do that. And I'm not sure why they sort of allowed it or why he went certain ways, but it was hard not to point at it and go, oh, he's going especially wacky. Like he's really turning it up.
Yeah, you know, there was a movie that came out a couple years ago called Mom and Dad, where everyone's got like some virus that makes them go crazy, and it's like, oh, there's never been a better film for him. You know, that is like a vehicle for him. Color from Space, I think he didn't successfully ruin the mood, and I think that has a lot to do with Richard Stanley. But I would have. I think he's still just, you know, what do I say? He's still just Nicolas Cage.
It's one of those things where it. But in the movie too, does it's like two movies almost to me. Once it hits a certain point, it becomes like a tone poem almost, and it just becomes this. You're just waiting for it to get to. It's got disturbing stuff in it. It's look, the guy's. I think it's literally like the second movie he's made.
I think it's about the fourth movie he's made.
Oh, see,
He's made a movie called Dust Devil. He made a movie called Hardware.
Oh, Hardware. Oh, yeah. No, wait. I take it back. Sorry. Yeah. I meant the first. Yes, I saw those. Those are what like got him the. he was like the hot thing for a bit, and that's how Moreau happened. Is that how it goes?
That's exactly how that happened. He actually made Moreau happen.
And then Moreau, he disappears for, 20 plus years, and then this is the first thing he's done since that. And I think Elijah Wood executive produced it or something, and that's how that relationship kind of happened, and he helped get this thing going.
Yeah, I'd like to see more movies from him.
Did you see the one that Elijah Wood did called Come to Daddy?
No.
I think you should see this, because it's the kind of thing that would be like an exploitation thing in the mid-70s. And it's an odd little movie, and it's very small. Like, there's only a few people in it. But one of the other faces in it is, I'm going to get his name wrong, but he's in so much stuff, and I like him so much. But he's a Canadian guy. Stephen McHattie? McHattie? He was in Pontypool. He's the DJ in Pontypool.
Oh.
He was in the Watchmen film where he was the original Night Owl. Stephen McHattie? McHattie? McTashy? Something? He's a Canadian guy.
Yeah, I'm trying to see. Yeah, Stephen McHattie.
He is in Come to Daddy. And Elijah Wood's great, but it is worth seeing just Stephen McHattie in this thing. And it's kind of bonkers.
He goes back. Like, he was Stephen McHattie. He's in the Yul Brynner, The Ultimate Warrior movie.
Oh, he's
holy cow.
He was kind of up there in Pontypool. You could sort of see it on his face, kind of.
I still think that's funny that you know what you Pontypool. It's just such a stoplight town.
Why?
It's actually set in the town not far from me called Pontypool. Mm-hmm. And my parents had friends that lived there, and when we went there, we'd always have to spend the night, and they're literally, I don't know what it's like now. I haven't been there in years, but back then it was like stop sign, variety store. Welcome to Pontypool.
Well, it's. Did you ever see? Have you seen the movie?
Yeah, years and years ago. Yeah, it's a.
I think it was like a stage play or something, because there's like one location pretty much for this thing.
Yeah, and, well, it's just a low budget Canadian film.
But it's in a radio, it's in like a radio station. Yeah. So it's kind of, everything sort of comes to the station. So it seems like it's this one location, and it's a good movie. That's a tough one to find, but that's a good movie. And you said something, Stephen, this made me think of something else that I was going to ask you about, this director. Oh man, might've been a Canadian dude. Now I can't think of it.
Bruce McDonald directed Pontypool. We went to the same college.
And he's done a bunch of stuff, that guy. And I can't. He's actually McHattie.
Hardcore Logo, which is probably my favorite film he's ever done.
Hardcore Logo. And Stephen McHattie is married to the woman in the movie, in Pontypool, actress is. Yeah, they ended up meeting on this and
getting. Hardcore Logo has a guy in it by the name of Hugh Dillon. He's a Canadian rock star. He has a band called The Headstones, who I'm a big fan of. And he's possibly the biggest star that never was. He just, like, he's wonderful in Hardcore Logo. And apparently Tarantino flew him to his house a couple of times because he really liked him, but they never ended up working together. And to wrap things around a little bit, Hardcore Logo stars an actor, a Canadian actor. What is his name? He's in a lot of stuff, but he's not, I wouldn't particularly call him famous, but he plays Bucky Haight. And his name's Julian Richens, that's it.
Okay.
He's a very thin British man, and he has been a Canadian staple for decades. Like, I've seen him in commercials. My friend Sean's first production was a short film starring Julian Richens.
Okay. So
that goes back to, like, the 90s, you know?
Yeah.
And he's in everything made in Toronto, you know, things like Shoot 'Em Up and Saw, and
that was it. Sorry. Yeah. Keep talking, but I remembered what I was going to ask you. But go ahead, Shoot 'Em Up.
But he ended up in Doom Patrol as that aging Nazi.
Oh, okay.
And the puppet guy, and it was like, oh, look at that Julian Richings. You know, like, I haven't. He keeps showing up and stuff, and it's awesome.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
You just said Shoot 'Em Up. Well, not Shoot 'Em Up. What's the one? Did you ever see A Field in England? Did you see that movie? Did you see High Rise?
Yes.
Okay. Ben Wheatley. So the guy who did High Rise is called Ben Wheatley. It's based on the J.G. Ballard book, but yes. Ben Wheatley. And he did Kill List and A Field in England and a couple others. And I was wondering if you had seen those because they're kind of, they're very odd. He's got an odd sort of tone to him. Kill List especially is a very violent, low budget kind of thing.
No, I haven't. I did watch a film recently. I watched a documentary about kung fu movies a couple of times over the course of the break because I kept finding new things. And have you ever heard of? Oh gosh. Oh man, my brain has turned to mud. Wow. Just give me a second here.
Take your time.
It's almost 11 o'clock here, so I'm...
For those of you still listening, I will be doing a tune from my easy listening selection of CDs, accompanied by the Hammond organ.
The Hammond organ. Not the harpsichord?
Not the harpsichord.
The film is called The Raid.
The Raid, the Hong Kong thing. They made six of them.
It's Thailand. Because I think they couldn't film stuff like that in Hong Kong anymore.
I
thought that was batshit amazing. The action
great.
In it. And then, believe it or not, I got this recommendation from Frank Conniff from Mystery Science Theater about a film called Fury. And he said it's the best action film I've seen in a long time. So
wait a minute. Who's
in this? No, just Frank Conniff recommended the film. No one is in it.
So is it new?
It's a new film. It's on Netflix, and it's about a single mother in Vietnam, and she's a badass. Like she's a debt collector, and then somebody kidnaps her kid for a child trafficking thing, and she just goes on a tear, trying to find her. And it is really a. It's an action film. There's some suspension of disbelief, but there's also just you can kind of feel for her. It's really well done. The action is fantastic.
Okay. I'll look that up.
She's a real, I really enjoyed it. I honestly couldn't turn it off. And that's the best recommendation. I put it on too late in the evening and then stayed up too late to finish it.
Were you and I talking about the glitch we have with subtitled movies where we're usually doing something else?
Yeah,
while the
that was
on.
The difference with Fury is I actually was watching it on TV. My wife and my daughter were watching Hamilton downstairs, and I.
What's Hamilton?
Hamilton is about the city of Hamilton. It takes place in a steel town.
Oh, Hamilton, my God.
Oh, and I just want to tell you that you want to talk about serendipity?
Yeah.
I was just looking at the news. John Hamm just signed to play Fletch.
What?
Yeah.
Is he there in your house? Is he listening to this show? How could he know?
He's in my house. He's in my wife's bed.
He's if I know those guys, they're going to be doing that isolation thing, and they're going to freaking bring up Fletch. I got to sign on the dotted line, so when the show hits, it's going to look like we were on his coattails. That's a very Hamm move, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. Hamm.
Hear that we're into Fletch, and then he goes and signs up for it, and
mind you,
whatever.
It's hard to live with me without mentioning Fletch at least once a day.
That's an interesting choice. I know nothing of the books, but who was it? Wasn't it for a long time that it was going to be like Kevin Smith was going to do it with Jason somebody?
Jason Lee.
Jason
and,
Lee.
And actually, I approve of that. I think they could have done a good
job. With that.
Yeah.
Well, Steve Zahn. Steve Zahn would be great.
No, he's not.
Yeah, I like Steve Zahn. I like him better than Jason Lee. I just got to say.
I like Steve Zahn.
He's also from Minnesota.
Who would have been obviously the perfect Fletch is
William Conrad?
Ryan Reynolds.
Ryan Reynolds. Here's the problem with Ryan Reynolds. And listen, we all love him. I love him. I've always liked him. Ryan Reynolds has to be careful that he doesn't start doing Ryan Reynolds performances because he's just kind of Ryan Reynolds all the time. And everything sort of sounds like Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah.
But yes, that would had if he had gotten it like 10 years ago or something.
Yeah,
before he
became professional smartass. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he would have been great. Or my man crush. What's his name? Ryan Gosling might have been good too. He would have had fun with it. He would have had a lot of fun with it. I think of the nice guys and that sort of hangdog look. He could have fun with Fletch.
Yeah, I don't quite see him in it, but I would probably still see it and check it out and see how he was.
And who's doing it?
I have no idea. No, it doesn't really say anything except it'll be based on the second novel, which is called Confess, Fletch.
It's just nice to hear that people are still signing deals and doing things because we need to get back to making happiness again somewhere, somehow.
Well, there's lots of happiness to be found. But on that note, we should probably wrap up.
Yeah, and serendipity.
Yeah, that I think before they start remaking Nicolas Cage movies with Nicolas Cage, let's...
Exactly. Well, there you go, folks. There's another, hour and a half or whatever of us talking about...
our time and your time.
Talking nonsense. But last time you guys heard this, and there were a lot of nice comments about what you guys were watching... what you've been doing with your time, and or if we always like hearing if you do take any recommendations and check stuff out, let us know because we love reading that stuff.
Yeah, the guys in the group, the Podstallions group, were all going on about this movie called Record City, and I'm so mad.
I saw it.
You saw it? Yeah. I'm so mad because I can't find it.
I commented on it. I was like, ugh, it's one of those things that you think is going to be a nostalgia fest. Won't this be kind of fun to see some signage from the mid to late 70s? And it is just, it just made me depressed.
Yeah, the presence of Rick Dees isn't a good sign for anyone.
It's just, it's like, remember how we make that joke about they're writing the script and like the joke was dated before it gets printed, before the script gets out. That was what it was. I mean, the stereotypes of every race, creed, and color in this thing are just... 90 feet tall, and it's just so, and it's not funny. It's not even interesting like in a novelty kind of way where you're a time capsule sort of thing.
It hurts going down.
It just hurts. It's just beige. it's painful. Yeah, Record City. Yeah,
that make me more angry to see it? Like I now it's like I'm gonna go on Amazon and buy it.
Just, you know what that is? I'm not crazy when I say this, but when you're doing the Prime thing, there's a list, and you're scrolling right. So the next one again, and then a lot of the times when you get to the end of whatever that list is, we like this wacky comedy about birds or whatever, or this wacky thing about record stores or whatever. That is the kind of thing that's the very last choice.
Yeah.
Like, they have managed to get to the very end where all the stuff previously a handful of people have seen, or 100 or 50 or 250, and then you get to, like, Record City. It's like four people that probably watched it, and it's the very end. And you go, I'll give this a try.
And the next one should just be your drunk, go to bed.
it should be just the color bars with the anthem and snow. That's it. Yeah.
The last thing I want to mention is I tried to watch. I've never seen Dragon Slayer, and I tried to watch it.
Peter McNichol, 81, 82, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Really beautifully made.
Oh yeah.
But man, does that need something?
Songs?
Maybe. it has great performances. It's almost like they just don't build the tension enough.
I just, as I have said many times, I love nostalgia. I love older things, and I love, the stuff that we grew up with. Not everything is great, and I love people.
Yeah,
I love that people embrace it. But I always use Tron as a great example of I loved Tron. I saw it a couple of times. I have the electronic game still. I had the toys. I got the Smucker's mail-away thing. And I had some coloring books and whatever. You know, but I know that, you know, especially as time went on, it was like, it's not a mile a minute. It's not like this action adventure thing. I love it for what it is, but I know its limitations as well. And Dragon Slayer is one of those things. Like Krull is kind of like this. Krull has got a lot of love.
Krull has so many vistas. Oh,
I don't know what it is, because I saw it in the theater and went, rip off. You know, like it just is like, okay, where's the monster? I saw him in the commercial. Where is he?
That's another movie I think I watched at like 35. I'd never seen Krull.
Oh, you did? Oh, okay.
No. I'm not a big fantasy guy, and I just, wait a minute, we're doing another episode here. I gotta go to bed. we just said goodbye, and it's like, hey, just, you know, I gotta keep talking.
You brought up Record City, and then
Slayer. Yeah, it'll be
our Hawk the Slayer episode.
Hawk the Slayer, I like. Okay, no, stop. All right, everybody.
All right, thanks, everybody. Hope everybody's safe and sound. We'll talk to you guys soon.
Be well. We'll talk soon.